welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for November 26, 2010. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, reducing the gender achievement gap in college science, using induced pluripotent stem cells to put diseases in a dish, and we read from your letters to Science Magazine. All this plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about how your blood holds clues to your birthday from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
Compared to men, women in the United States are earning fewer degrees in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. And that gap persists, despite many efforts to remove obstacles and encourage women to pursue the sciences. While the persistence of the gap has been blamed on everything from differences in science preparation earlier in life to differences in cognitive abilities, new research suggests that there may be a psychological component. As Science's Sophia Kai reports, a simple psychological intervention can substantially reduce the gender gap.
The education gender gap in the U.S. has rapidly narrowed in recent decades, with women now earning the same number, if not more, undergraduate and doctorate degrees as men, but not in the sciences.
The idea of gender gaps and even racial gaps in performance in different academic spheres is a question that's been lingering and persistent.
Tony Schmader is a psychologist at the University of British Columbia.
Because all of the changes that have been made over the past several decades to really reduce any kind of institutional obstacles to women's ability to succeed, all the programs that are out there to encourage women and minorities to go into the sciences, all of those things have had benefits, but this gap still persists.
Indeed, men consistently outperform women on tests in science, and women are earning substantially fewer doctorates in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics.
And so that's raised the question, what else is remaining that's an obstacle? And so research from this kind of perspective suggests that there are psychological obstacles that are simply created by being in a society where certain groups of people are underrepresented in some domains.
And in a paper in this week's Science, Akira Miyake and colleagues report that this gender achievement gap is substantially reduced by using a form of psychological intervention called values affirmation.
Women who did better as a result of this affirmation might choose to pursue their science education and even choose some career related to science.
The values affirmation exercise Miyake and his colleagues administered is simple.
This is a writing exercise that takes about 15 minutes. And in this exercise, students were given a list of different values, like family and friends, learning and gaining knowledge, religion, politics, you know, all sorts of different kinds of things. And they selected two or three values that they value most and wrote about them, why those things matter to those students.
While previous research has shown that this kind of values affirmation exercise works to reduce minority achievement gaps in school-age children, Miyake wanted to see if these results held for older students, those in first-year university physics classes.
And so there is some sort of a gap, achievement gap, between men and women in introductory physics class. And even if you adjust for pre-existing differences, there is still a substantial gap in exam scores.
At least in the class Miyake and his colleagues chose to study, a physics class at his university, the University of Colorado, in which year after year, men not only outnumber women, but they consistently perform better on exams and earn higher course grades. Now, one reason may be preparation, as men often enter college with better physics training than women.
But among the people who did the affirmation exercise, this gender gap was significantly reduced.
Miyake and his colleagues compared test results, final course grades, and to test learning of concepts, scores on a standardized conceptual physics exam taken at the beginning and at the end of the course that did not factor into the students' grades.
Also, in terms of course grades, A, B, C, D, letter grades, what we found was that among the men, control versus values affirmation, different writing exercises didn't make much of a difference. But for women, doing affirmation increased B's and reduced C's. So there is a change in the distribution of letter grades. If you do well, and if you get B instead of C, that's really psychologically different. You feel much better about your competence, your capability in learning physics and learning science, and that kind of initial impact in a gateway course like this might be quite important.
In addition, Miyake and his colleagues found that among control group students, who were asked to choose the values least important to them and write about other people's perceptions of those values, there was still a substantial gender achievement gap. And these effects were most pronounced in women who, according to a survey, tended to believe the stereotype that men are better than women at physics.
So it really changes the way I think we think about how we can go about reducing the gender gap in science.
Again, Tony Schmader of the University of British Columbia, who says scientists aren't really sure why this intervention works.
Well, it's just an effective mood. Mood dissipates pretty quickly, right? And you come in the next day and you feel completely differently depending on what's going on.
Indeed, this simple generalized intervention early on in the course can dramatically improve women's performance throughout the course. It could be that this values affirmation is helping women learn the material better, which elevated scores on the standardized conceptual test suggests. Or it could be that this intervention, which really has nothing to do with physics, is simply helping women perform better on tests. Schmader says it's probably a little bit of both.
It means that you go into the next situation, the next exam, the next classroom exercise, the next group project, having a different frame because you were less threatened the last time, and that means you can be less threatened the next time you go into a similar context. And so these things can build on each other and produce these long-lasting effects over time.
But, study author Miyake says, there's still work to do to find out if these semester-long lasting effects could translate to more women getting their doctorates in the sciences down the road.
And so it's an interesting possibility that this kind of affirmation, this kind of intervention could have really long-term effects. It might not be restricted to this particular course. And that longitudinal effect of this affirmation is something that we're also interested in studying.
For Science Magazine, I'm Sophia Kai.
Read Miyake and colleagues' paper, Reducing the Gender Achievement Gap in College Science, a classroom study of values affirmation. Find it in this week's Science.
For a long time, scientists have hoped to use stem cells to study disease, not only to treat disease, but to find out how the disease actually works. And for the first time, those techniques are really taking off.
Science's Gretchen Vogel reports in this week's issue on how cells from hundreds of patients are giving scientists the chance to model diseases in new ways, putting diseases in a dish.
And the story talks about the specific diseases that are being studied and what other diseases might also be a target of these techniques.
What do these techniques consist of exactly?
So a few years ago, scientists figured out how by just inserting a handful of genes into skin cells or blood cells taken from patients, they can sort of turn the cell's genetic clock backwards and make them into pluripotent cells, which means that these cells can become any cell type in the body. They're the kind of cells that you find in early embryos that still have the potential to become any kind of tissue. And so that made it possible suddenly to make these powerful cells from anyone, essentially, including patients with lots of different diseases. And scientists have now done that and have hundreds of cell lines from patients with dozens of different diseases, and they're starting to use those cells to study what goes wrong in the lab.
What are some examples of these diseases that have been put into a dish, so to speak?
There's a bunch of examples. Some of them are more common. So Huntington's disease is well known. Parkinson's disease. People have made cell lines from people with diabetes and even with Alzheimer's. Some of the most exciting examples, though, have come from diseases that are a bit more rare, some rare genetic diseases that for various reasons turn out to be easier to study.
And why are they easier to study?
Because scientists know a little bit more about exactly what causes them. So these rare genetic diseases typically are due to a single gene that goes wrong during development, and so the system is just a little simpler. One example is a disease called spinal muscular atrophy, a really horrible genetic disease that strikes children and causes their neurons essentially to degenerate. In the worst case, the patients die by age 2. Scientists know exactly which protein is missing in these children, and they even have an idea of how you might be able to fix the problem in cells by making the cell make more of the missing protein. And what they've done with iPS cells, induced pluripotent stem cells. They have been able to take cells from a patient and grow them in the lab and test a bunch of different potential drugs to see if those cells respond and make more of the missing protein.
So is the idea then that these induced pluripotent cells from diseased patients, these diseases in a dish, respond to a drug in the same way as diseased cells in a patient would?
That's the idea, exactly. And until now, scientists haven't had access to some of the kinds of cells that are affected by certain diseases. For example, you can get lots of skin cells from a patient, but it's harder to get lots of neurons from a patient. And this technology allows scientists to grow as many neurons with the genetic makeup of the patient as they want. There are, of course, limitations to this technique. In many cases, diseases affect more than one kind of cell, or what happens in a disease happens to a whole organ, or what happens to the cells depends on the context the cell is in. So it's not perfect. Oftentimes, isolated cells in a dish don't perfectly reflect the disease, but this is a step in the right direction for many of those diseases. A good example is amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, Lou Gehrig's disease. Scientists have been using this technique to study that disease. They've made neurons from patients with ALS, and the neurons do behave in some ways differently than those derived from cells from normal controls. But it looks like from other studies that neuronal cells called glia and astrocytes, that there are interactions between these different types of cells that are key in the disease process. And scientists are still working on the best way to model that kind of interaction in the dish.
Are scientists able to apply lessons learned from one genetic disease to another genetic disease, or are they unique enough that scientists have to essentially tackle each disease one by one?
It kind of depends. For example, one of the most recent papers to come out described Rett's syndrome, a disease that, again, attacks children and, among other things, causes them to have symptoms similar to autism. This is a genetic disease where people know exactly what goes wrong. They know the gene that's responsible, but they hope that some of the problems that they see with neurons derived from iPS cells that are taken from Rett's patients might even shed light on what goes wrong with more common autism spectrum disorders. So it kind of depends. There are some diseases that can serve as a model for other diseases, but for the genetic diseases, oftentimes they're different enough that there isn't so much overlap. And that's one of the benefits of this technology. You can examine the exact genetic makeup of patients in the lab more easily and more accessibly than you ever could before.
More easily and more accessibly. Are they, in fact, exact? I mean, is the reprogramming process at that level that there isn't much variability?
That is another one of the challenges for the field. That's something that scientists are still working out. Certainly the first generation of reprogramming technologies made cells that didn't seem to be always fully reprogrammed, and it wasn't clear how much differences, if you observe differences in two kinds of cells, whether those differences were due to real genetic differences between the cells that might have something to do with the disease, or maybe were due to differences in the reprogramming process, in which case you'd be on a wild goose chase. But those problems are gradually being overcome, and scientists are finding better ways to reprogram cells that produce more consistent reprogrammed cells. So that's something that people are studying actively, but most of these experiments include careful controls, and scientists are trying to watch for and rule out reprogramming differences as a difference in their cellular results.
You say these reprogrammed cells are essentially turning the clock back. So will this technique be useful then for diseases that are maybe more than genetics? They're epigenetic, or there are environmental factors that also contribute to the disease, not just genetics?
That is the hope. Scientists definitely hope that they'll be able to get a handle on some of the environmental causes or the epigenetic causes of diseases that happen sporadically and that are due to a combination of perhaps genetic predisposition and then environmental exposure of some sort. That includes, for example, Parkinson's disease or ALS or even schizophrenia, where people with very similar genetic backgrounds, even identical twins, don't always both get the disease. It's not fully clear yet exactly how well cells in a dish are going to reflect the environmental factors that might trigger disease. For example, cells taken from Parkinson's patients that scientists then made into the neurons that are affected in Parkinson's disease looked completely normal in the dish. They weren't able to find anything different about dopamine-producing neurons from Parkinson's patients versus control cells. And so that seems to be a disease that scientists are looking for other ways to get a handle on that. They still hope that something might turn up or that they might be able to use these cells to test better drugs or other treatments, but it's not yet possible to perfectly model all the diseases that scientists would like to.
Gretchen Vogel, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Science's Gretchen Vogel reports in this week's issue on how cells from hundreds of patients are giving scientists the chance to model diseases in new ways, putting diseases in a dish. Now, David Grimm, Science's online news editor, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about how your blood holds clues to your birthday. Something about the blood itself, Dave?
Well, something about the cells in the blood. These are your T cells, which are your immune cells, or at least part of your immune defense system. These are the cells that help the body recognize invaders and help the body attack these invaders and get rid of them. But T cells do something really interesting. T cells have to recognize a whole variety of threats. Can you imagine all of the bacteria and microbes and everything else you encounter on a daily basis? Well, all of those things look very different to the body. And for the T cell to be able to recognize it, it has to create a variety of different proteins on its surface, which are called receptor proteins, to help it recognize these invaders. And to do that, the T cells basically chop up a bunch of their DNA and recombine it. And by recombining it, they create all these different types of proteins that they then put on their cell surface.
So the more proteins that they have on their cell surface, the older they are?
Well, not quite. It turns out when these T cells are chopping up all their DNA to make these proteins, there's a lot of DNA left over, and it forms these little DNA circles in the cell that are basically cellular garbage. They just sort of hang around, but they're pretty much useless to the cell. Well, it turns out as you get older, you have fewer and fewer T cells, which means you have fewer and fewer of these little garbage DNA circles. And now a team of researchers has found a correlation between the number of these DNA circles you have and how old you are. Basically, the fewer circles you have, the older you are.
And how good is this correlation? How closely can they guess someone's age based on these circles and T cells?
Well, they can guess your age to about 9 years, plus or minus 9 years. Now, that may not seem like a lot, but what the researchers are really hoping in terms of applications for this research are forensic applications. You can imagine detectives finding blood at a crime scene, and they need to narrow down their suspect pool. And maybe some of their suspects are in their 50s and 60s, and some of the other suspects are in their 20s and 30s. Well, even though this blood test is only accurate to about 9 years, it can very easily tell you whether somebody's, say, in their 20s and 30s versus being in their 50s or 60s. So it can help researchers, or it could help detectives, determine what generation a person is based on a blood sample.
And police find that helpful, it sounds like.
Well, they do, because, you know, if you watch detective shows, it seems like police have so many tools at their disposal. They can look at DNA, and they can do all these other things at the crime scene. They can look at fingerprints. But things like DNA and fingerprints only help if you've got something to compare it to. If you've already got a suspect, or if you've got a database, a DNA or a fingerprint database to match it to. But what if you've just got a blood sample and you have no idea how to match it up? Again, this isn't going to tell you exactly who the blood came from, but it does help police narrow things down. And so it could be another important tool in their toolbox.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave. So what other stories have you brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, speaking of blood, this next story is about how tumors create their own blood supply. Now, we already know that part of the reason tumors are so successful, unfortunately, in the body is because they're actually able to recruit blood to themselves. It's a process known as angiogenesis. Basically, what happens is if a tumor starts getting really big, it needs a lot more nutrients. And in order to do that, it sends out all of these growth factors, which prompts the body to create more blood vessels around the tumor, send more blood to the tumor, and the tumor grows. So researchers already knew that that happened. What's different here is researchers have found that the tumor itself can turn into blood vessels. So parts of the tumor can actually morph into blood vessels, thereby creating their own supply of blood. They don't have to have the body create blood vessels for them. They can make their own.
Does this new understanding help with efforts to try and cut the tumor's blood supply off?
Well, it does, because there's actually a lot of drugs out there, so-called anti-angiogenesis drugs, that are designed to cut off the tumor's blood supply. And the problem is that a lot of these drugs stop working after a few months, and researchers really couldn't figure out why. And this study may explain that, because what it indicates is that even if you cut off the body's healthy blood vessels that are connecting the tumor just goes around and says, well, that's fine. You cut off my supply. I'm just going to make my own blood vessels. And that is something that seems to be skirting the effectiveness of these drugs. And so the researchers suggest that perhaps in the future, these anti-angiogenesis therapies be combined with an anti-stem cell therapy. They think it's these tumor stem cells in the tumor that are actually creating these blood supplies. So not only do you cut off the body's blood supply, but you prevent the tumor from creating its own blood vessels. And maybe that 1-2 punch would actually be enough to kill the tumor.
Okay. So last story, what's this last one about?
Well, Rob, from tumors surrounding themselves with blood vessels to our sun being surrounded by its siblings, this last story is about trying to find the sun's long-lost brothers and sisters.
Why are researchers trying to do that?
Well, Robert, this all has to do with trying to figure out how our solar system formed. There was probably some unique properties of our sun that allowed that to happen. But only by comparing our sun to other highly related suns can we test that hypothesis. The trick is, can we actually find these 1,000 or so stars that our sun was born with?
I imagine it's quite a challenge with the enormous number of stars in our galaxy. What tools are researchers using to find the siblings of our sun?
Well, they don't have a lot to work with. What researchers think happened is about 4.6 billion years ago, the sun and hundreds of other stars were born in this localized cluster of stars, and then gradually over time they spread out. The best researchers can do to try to understand what happened there is to create simulations. And about a couple of years ago, a researcher did create a simulation on a computer that tried to figure out where all these stars would go over billions of years. And what he found was, according to his simulation, there was somewhere between 10 and 60 of these stars would still be hanging around in our cosmic neighborhood. And they would actually be able to be so close that you could theoretically see them with binoculars in the night sky. And that gave astronomers some hope that, hey, some of these solar siblings are not too far away and they could be fairly easily studied. But a new study has just come out that says, wait a minute, these stars are not going to be as easy to find as this one astronomer said they were. What this new group did was they also used computer simulations, but their computer simulations were a lot more advanced. They took into account a lot of the complex gravity that occurs in the Milky Way. The Milky Way's spiral arms actually exert a lot of gravity on stars that can sort of toss them to and fro. And what they found is that even under the best case scenario, there might only be 3 or 4 solar siblings within 330 light years of Earth. That's pretty far away, and that's not very many siblings. And you're talking about finding these guys among the enormous number of stars that are out there in the Milky Way.
So suppose they identify some target star they think that might be a solar sibling. Any way to confirm that?
Well, one way to confirm that would be to see if these stars have very similar chemical properties, if they're the same class of stars as our sun. That would be a good clue. But one expert says that's not even enough. He says there's a lot of stars out there that actually are very similar to our sun, have very similar properties, but are in no way related. And he thinks this is a bit of a fool's errand to go around looking for these solar siblings.
So you can tell whether they're not related that way.
Well, that's a tough question, Rob. But as the original researcher says, the scientist that a couple of years ago first made this claim that we could find these solar siblings, he thinks it is still worth looking for these relatives of our sun because of what they could tell us about how we got here in the first place.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for the site?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we've got a story about an obesity epidemic that goes beyond humans. It extends to our domestic animals and even to the laboratory rats. And also a story about a light-bending black hole that may offer clues to extra dimensions in the universe. And on Science Insider, Science's policy site, we've got a story about BP's relationship with scientists now and what it was during the spill. Looks like there was some cooperation, but also a bit of contention. And also a story about a new trial to test the efficacy of embryonic stem cells for treating disease. So be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news, plus all the stories on the science policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org. Finally today, we read from your letters to Science Magazine. Joining me is our letters editor, Jennifer Sills.
This month, we start with a letter in response to an August 13th story titled Out of Sight that was part of our special section on scaling up alternative energy. In that story, news writer Eli Kintish reported that engineers reduced the death toll of birds of prey by spacing wind turbines farther apart and removing turbines from problematic sites at the Altamont Pass Wind Resource Area in California. Douglas Bell of East Bay Regional Park District in Oakland, California, and K. Sean Smallwood of Davis, California, write, "These statements are misleading."
In fact, the authors write, numerous mitigation measures recommended by the Scientific Review Committee as part of the Alameda County Avian Wildlife Protection Program were never implemented, or implemented in a piecemeal manner. Neither total avian fatality rates nor fatality rates of focal raptors have decreased. Some fatality rates may have actually increased. Given that little has been done to implement substantial mitigation measures, such high rates for golden eagles, as for other species, will likely continue.
The authors conclude, to reduce bird deaths, we must either, one, abandon the site altogether for wind energy production, or two, replace existing infrastructure with fewer, larger wind turbines, and choose their locations by using map-based technologies that incorporate mortality studies and species-specific avian flight behavior, or avian land use patterns. Even then, no single sighting plan can take into account the patterns of all avian species. What works for birds might not work for bats.
You can read the full letter in the November 12th issue of Science. Our next letter is also from that issue and comes in response to a September 24th editorial by Molly Cook, titled Science for Physicians. The real issue, Cook concluded in her editorial, is not why basic science, or how much of it, is needed during formal medical education. Instead, the question is how this science is to be much more effectively taught, both throughout the entire 7 to 10 year period of medical school, internship, and residency, and in the continuing education required of physicians.
Glenn Jones of Credit Valley Hospital and McMaster University in Ontario, Canada, writes in response to say that while basic science training is certainly crucial for future physicians, and effective patient care requires physicians to keep pace with change in the natural sciences, clinical practice also requires the recognition that social sciences are equally important.
Jones continues, incorporating good social science involves more than establishing health values and economics and acknowledging diversity. Rather, physicians must understand patient autonomy and be sensitive to each patient's unique preferences and experience. Excessive focus on natural science education, including the technologies underlying personalized genetic medicine, could further dehumanize care.
In the past decade, Jones concludes, treatments have improved spectacularly in all oncology subdisciplines. Yet, patient concerns, distress, and satisfaction ratings have remained unchanged. Understanding the relevant natural science does not necessarily translate into a physician's ability to communicate with patients, nor does it guarantee informed consent. The most basic education for a physician is learning to develop a helpful and caring relationship with every patient.
Our final letter is from this week's issue and is part of our Life in Science series. Daniel Chomovitz from Tel Aviv University writes in to relate a story about the psychological challenges of running a lab and the therapy he and his lab team got.
I had just returned from a year-long sabbatical abroad, Chomovitz begins. Refreshed, I looked forward to beginning another productive year. My plans were soon derailed. In my absence, the social fabric of my lab had deteriorated to the point where squabbling, backstabbing, and even screaming were common. My response to this turmoil was indecisive at best. After one particularly painful encounter, it dawned on me that I was in way over my head.
In desperation, Chomovitz continues, I turned to the head of my university's human resource office, who was a trained family therapist. Her diagnosis? We were a dysfunctional family, complete with rebellious adolescents, senior students, impressionable children, junior students, and impotent parents, technicians, and the principal investigator.
Shemovitz concludes, I don't know if it was the shock of forced group therapy or the skill of the therapist, but the sessions worked. The students and technicians relearned how to live and work together. The new students in the lab weren't exposed to continued tension, and I regained control of the lab. Years in science had done little to prepare me for the psychological challenges of running a lab. I've since recommended the use of an organizational psychologist to several other lab heads. A few hours of concentrated work can go a long way toward resolving interpersonal problems, and more productive science is sure to follow.
You can read the full letter in this week's Science. Thanks, Jennifer.
Thanks, Rob.
Jennifer Sills is the letters editor of Science Magazine. And that wraps up the November 26th, 2010 Science Magazine podcast. Thanks to Sophia Kai for her help with this week's show. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine with the support of AAAS, the Science Society. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.